This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, Lord! Why have you chosen me? What would you have me do for you?
I shall give you my laws, and you shall take them unto the people.
Yes, Lord! Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Oi. 10 commandments for all to obey!
That's Mel Brooks as Moses in a scene from his film History of the World, Part 1. We're about to get a more historically accurate picture of biblical times. My guest, Mark Zvi Brettler, is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. It's about Jewish interpretations of the Old Testament and how they compare with Christian interpretations, including their different understandings of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. The book explains how modern Jewish scholars tried to interpret the Bible and understand the culture that produced it. Brettler is a professor of biblical literature and chair of the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University. Do Jewish people view the Old Testament differently from Christians?
Jews view the Old Testament so fundamentally differently from Christians that they wouldn't even use the term Old Testament. Using that term assumes that the Old Testament is really half of the Bible that is combined with the New Testament, and thus most Jews will prefer using the term Hebrew Bible or some similar terms, which suggests that the Bible for Jews comprises only a certain number of books. It does not include the Gospels, does not include the Epistles, and is a fundamentally different book.
Let's take a look at Genesis, the story of creation. Now, there's two different versions of the story in the Bible. Where are they both located?
Well, the first story obviously starts at the very beginning in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and it runs through the middle of verse 4 of the second chapter of the Bible. This is a story which has a very short introduction. It then talks about the 6 days of creation, and then it has a conclusion which talks about the Sabbath. The second story is actually the better-known story, and that is the story that talks about the Garden of Eden, talks about the creation of woman from the rib, or other translations, from the side of man. And these are two fundamentally different stories with fundamentally different ideas, which I'm at least trying to argue, and here I'm very much part of the mainstream of biblical scholarship. These two stories should be read primarily as separate stories rather than combined together.
What are some of the most important differences between these two different versions of creation?
Well, I would actually say that the most significant difference is in terms of gender. There have been a lot of interpretations that have tried to connect gender studies to biblical texts. But in the first creation story, man and woman are both created at the same time. And according to most scholars, in terms of the way they understand the verse, they are both created in the image of God. And I'm referring to Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, which can be translated as God created person or humanity in his image. In the image of God did he create it. Male and female did he create them. In contrast to that, the second story has a very different order of creation. Adam is created first. God has a sense that Adam is lonely and creates all sorts of animals to bring before Adam. And it's really a comic scene if you allow yourself to laugh at the Bible, which I think in some cases is a good idea. You could imagine God is bringing the crocodile before Adam. Adam says, no, 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 this is not going to work for me. Then the hippopotamus, etc. No fitting mate for Adam is found. And only then, from the rib or the side of man, is Eve created. Now, there's a big debate about whether or not, in biblical scholarship, about whether or not this represents subservience of woman to man or not. But what is clear from the second story is that after eating from the fruit, God speaks to the woman, and one of the things that he says is that he, namely Adam, shall rule over you. So no matter how we read the rest of the text, those particular words seem to suggest a subservient role of women to men, while in the first creation story, we have absolutely nothing like that.
Well, how do you reconcile this major difference?
Well, the answer is I refuse to ask your question. I don't think that these two stories should be reconciled. Much of what I'm trying to argue in How to Read the Bible is that the Bible is fundamentally an anthology rather than a unitary work or a unified work. And as such, we need to hear the different voices that are in the text. And thus, nothing upsets me more when I hear people say, the Bible says, and then they finish that sentence. And what they're really doing is they're picking one particular section of the Bible and ignoring what other sections say.
A good example would be if you're using the second Genesis story to explain that men are of greater stature than women, that women were created to be man's helpmate.
You're right, that would be a great example. Or since you asked me about both creation stories, perhaps a more theological example would be if somebody looked at Genesis chapter 1 and tried to imagine what God looks like with a broader depiction of God in that particular chapter. God is clearly highly majestic in that chapter. God says something and it comes true. Nature responds to God. However, in the second creation story, you do not have the same structure of majesty. There you have, and one could always wonder how literally this should be taken, God saying to Adam, "Where are you?" There you have a whole story which is based on a notion of God saying to Adam, "You can do everything but this." And especially those of us who are parents have a good sense that if you do that, you clearly know that your child is going to violate the one thing that he or she was told is not permissible. And thus, it's a very different image of God that you have in the second chapter. And which one is right? I don't know. They both appear, at least in my Bible, in the same size font, and it becomes very hard to decide how to balance which one is more correct or more accurate. And thus, I almost never want to say, the Bible says.
Yeah, well, you read the Bible more as story or myth than as history or science. So when you read the Bible as story or myth, what does it mean to you? What is the value of that?
Well, I'm glad you used the word myth first. Myth is a very problematic word, and I really wish that I could find a better term to use. But when I read the Bible as myth, I don't read it as a myth in the sense that many Americans think of a myth as a silly story or something that should not be believed in, but rather as a story that is attempting to charter fundamental values of a society. And I try to understand what these values are. Thus, the first creation story is trying to charter a world which is incredibly well organized, in which everything is in its place. I imagine the first creation story in terms of cubbies, and everything can be assigned into the proper cubby and is in perfect order. While the second creation story is imagining a world, which I must admit is much closer to the world that I know, a world which is somewhat messy, a world in which things do not go always as planned. For example, the notion that God could try creating animals as helpmates for people, but that doesn't work out. So God tries something else, and the second thing works out better. So I imagine these stories as ways of my ancestors, the ancient Israelites, really struggling with trying to understand the world and doing this in a way which was very common in such ancient societies, namely through stories rather than through science. And these stories, I believe, were not meant to be understood literally by and large.
So when you hear people making the case for intelligent design or creationism, based on the Bible, what do you say?
Well, I say to them that the first words of the Bible are not, "This is science." And I really ask them, why do they believe that this material is science? After all, a myth can be true without necessarily being literally true or scientific. I mean, let me give you an example of what I mean by that. I could say of a person, "She is a rose," and somebody who is very literally minded could say to me, "Hold it, how can you say that the person is a rose? That person does not have beautiful petals. That person does not have a beautiful fragrance. That person does not have thorns, perhaps." And I would simply answer, "Hold it, you don't understand. I'm speaking metaphorically. And as such, a statement such as 'this is a rose' does not have the same truth value as a statement 'this is a pen,' or 'this is a school,' or 'this is a radio show.' And as such, if you understand something metaphorically literally, you're really misunderstanding it. Similarly, if you understand a myth as science, you are fundamentally misunderstanding it."
My guest is Mark Zvi Brettler. His new book is called How to Read the Bible. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Zvi Brettler, and he's the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. He is the chair of the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University, where he's also a professor of biblical studies. We talked a little bit about the Genesis story. Let's talk a little bit about the Ten Commandments. Are there controversies among biblical scholars about the meaning of any of the Ten Commandments and how they should be interpreted?
There are lots of controversies about the Ten Commandments. In fact, there's even a controversy about what they should be called. In English, we call them the Ten Commandments. The Hebrew does not say Ten Commandments. The Hebrew is Aseret HaDevarim, which means the Ten Sayings or the Ten Things. And if you look at various discussions of the Ten Commandments, you'll see that this difference in terminology really does make a difference. If you ask most non-Jews where the Ten Commandments begin, they will answer with a particular commandment: "You shall have no other gods before me." If you ask many Jews where the Ten Commandments begin, they will begin it with, "I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt," and so forth. And thus, whether you call them commandments or not, does make a very, very big difference in terms of what you include within them and where they begin. To say the obvious, the Ten Commandments do not have Roman numerals in the original Hebrew text. And as such, if you read them very carefully, you'll see that there are actually 13 or 14 statements which need to be divided into 10. Different religious traditions, different biblical scholars do this in a number of different ways. And to give you a sense of a controversy that exists within biblical scholarship, the last one, or according to other enumerations, the last two of these so-called commandments deal with coveting. And one question is, how can a commandment really talk about something that is internal to you? And scholars continue to debate whether in what I would call the Decalogue, which is a Greek term which really means the Ten Sayings, whether this is talking about desiring and desiring the heart is fundamentally wrong, or whether the particular unusual Hebrew verb that is used there actually refers to desiring which you act upon. So that's one fundamental difference that you have within biblical scholarship about what part of the Decalogue means. But there's a much bigger difference about what is included in the Decalogue and how it should be divided up into various sections.
Is the amount of emphasis that's placed on the Ten Commandments different in the history of Judaism than it is in the history of Christianity?
Yeah, I know less about the importance of the Decalogue in the history of Christianity, but I can answer that both in terms of the history of Judaism and even in terms of the history of Jewish printing. At some point, it became commonplace to have pictures of the Decalogue on the front piece of Jewish books. this was influenced by Christianity, which had it first. And in fact, when some of these Hebrew books were first published, people were wondering if the printers were really Jewish or if the printers were Christian. And this indicates that the Ten Commandments, or the Decalogue, was not really as prominent in Judaism as it was in Christianity. You have to remember that when you read the Bible as a whole, it is not the case that the Ten Commandments are the beginning of the Bible or at the end of the Bible or even right in the middle of the Bible. In other words, they're not really in a place of extreme prominence. So they're halfway through the book of Exodus. They're in the fifth chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. And nowhere do the Ten Commandments say either, I am the center of the Bible, or I am the main ethical lesson of the Bible. In my sense, especially listening to the contemporary American debate, is that this is something which has very much entered America from a Christian side rather than from Judaism or even from the place that the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue holds within the Hebrew Bible itself.
What surprises me to hear this is there is Jewish law. And I always assumed that the Ten Commandments were part of that and that that was a very important part of Jewish history, the laying down of and the following of Jewish law.
Yes, the Ten Commandments are part of Jewish law. But at least as the rabbis enumerated the laws in the Bible, there are a total of 613 laws. And so the Ten Commandments are some part of that. And it is not the case that according to all Jewish tradition, all of the laws of the Decalogue are important than all of the other 603 laws that you might have elsewhere in the Bible. And the second thing that needs to be said about the first part of the Bible, about the Torah, is that it is not all law. And the stories, and I would really argue the stories understood as myths, which help constitute a society and its values, are important on par with the laws themselves.
Does your interpretation of the Ten Commandments and their relative importance as a Jewish biblical scholar affect your position on the public display of Ten Commandments in courthouses or, you know, in public squares?
Yeah, I have a very strong feeling about that. And you might imagine that as a biblical scholar, I would love to see the Ten Commandments all over the place because, in a sense, it's publicizing the book that I teach, and that is extremely meaningful to me. But on the other hand, I'm very bothered by the public display for a number of reasons. First of all, most public displays call them the Ten Commandments. These are not really Ten Commandments, especially from the Jewish perspective, where the Decalogue, what others call the Ten Commandments, begins with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So just the title, Ten Commandments, already is removing it from the Jewish tradition. Secondly, in all of the statues that I've seen, or all the monuments for the Ten Commandments, they have very specific numerations. What is commandment number one? What is commandment number two? There are significant Jewish-Christian differences, and even differences within different branches of Christianity about how to enumerate the various commandments. And thus, any statue is going to take a particular choice and thus enfranchise one religious group rather than another religious group. There are other reasons I object. One of the commandments, according to many enumerations, it's the seventh commandment. In the Hebrew, it is Lo Tirtzach. Almost all of the monuments follow the King James translation, which says, Thou shalt not kill. That is simply not what the Hebrew means. The Hebrew means, Thou shalt not kill illicitly, Thou shalt not murder. We can talk about whether this is for better or for worse, but the Hebrew Bible does include the notion of capital punishment. It does include the notion of just war. So thus, many of the translations bother me as well. And finally, I really wonder whether or not the Decalogue in its full form should have a place, especially in public buildings like courts. After all, one of the issues that is discussed in the Decalogue, if it is read in its entirety rather than its condensed version on many of these monuments, is the notion of intergenerational punishment, where children and even grandchildren, great-grandchildren are punished for sins which earlier generations had perpetrated. And I would really wonder what place this notion should have in sites like public courthouses. You put all of those reasons together, and I really believe that these monuments must be kept out of public spaces, they should be kept out of schools, they should be especially be kept out of public courthouses.
Mark Zvi Brettler is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. He chairs the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Zvi Brettler, author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. It discusses how modern Jewish scholars interpret the Hebrew Bible. He chairs the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University, where he teaches biblical literature. When you teach Bible classes now, are the interpretations that you teach considerably different from the ones that you were taught? And if they are, would you choose an example to show the interpretation that you were taught versus what you teach now?
The interpretations that I teach are certainly very different than the ones which I was taught as a child going to a Jewish school. I guess the best way of representing this is to look at the stories that talk about the ancestors, what many people would call the patriarchs, but I think it's more important to be broader than that. The stories about Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and his wives, where very often many people who read the Bible, and this is quite true within Jewish tradition, will understand these ancestors as models or as heroes that you are supposed to follow, and thus will whitewash certain things that are in the text which seem to suggest otherwise. While the interpretations that I offer in class and in my various books suggest that these are not really hero stories at all, that these people are not being presented or represented as role models that one needs to follow, but rather are stories that are working out values in various ways, stories that in some cases are entertainment, in some cases, perhaps even high entertainment. And I would just point out that nowhere in the Bible does it say that these ancestors are ideal. And I think that the Bible is much more interested in showing human characters as characters with all of their foibles and is not really interested in showing them as heroic or as role models. That would be really one of the biggest differences between the way in which I was taught the Bible and the way in which I teach the Bible to others.
You write that in part of the interpretive literature of the Hebrew Bible, there's a tradition of describing God at the moment of revelation as a statue with faces on every side. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance of that is most people claim that they understand revelation, that they understand the Bible, and that there is a simple meaning that the biblical text has. What that particular rabbinic passage, which you quoted, means to emphasize is that there is something fundamentally subjective about the understanding of each individual of the Bible, that each individual looks at the Bible and sees it from a different vantage point, sees a different face in the Bible, sees a different understanding of the divine by reading the Bible. And what that particular rabbinic text emphasizes is that each of those interpretations is legitimate, because actually that particular rabbinic tradition is an interpretation of the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments of, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Their you is in the singular rather than in the plural. Hebrew makes that distinction. And the point that the text is trying to make is that the subjectiveness of interpretation of each individual looking at the divine and looking at the biblical text is something legitimate, is something to be applauded, rather than something to anguish about as we search for the single correct voice in the Bible.
Which means that you're never searching for the single correct voice in the Bible.
I never am. I correct myself very quickly whenever I begin a sentence that says, "The Bible says."
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Mark Zvi Brettler is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible.